During this process, I had a visit from Rudy Kaufner. Rudy was the fellow who had invented the traveling wave tube. Trained as an architect, became interested in electronics, and I think he did the traveling wave work, I believe, in England, and then came and joined Bell Labs. Rudy was very much involved in a very new device known as the Maser.
Mm-hmm.
They were trying to build good Maser structures to use as instruments for measurement of very low microwave signals. And Rudy came over and said, "You know, we have a problem here, and I wonder if there's a metallurgical way to solve it. We need pretty high magnetic fields. We need them over a substantial volume." He said, "To build coils that will produce those fields, they dissipate a lot of energy. But the crystals that we need to use have to be cooled to liquid helium temperature." So we have a problem, he said. And he said, "It just occurred to me that if we could make superconducting magnets, we have to cool the stuff down to liquid helium temperature anyway, and we wouldn't have the dissipation problem."
Mm-hmm.
So I went in and talked to Gene Kunstler about it. Gene was a good scientist, but he also really liked to make things that worked. And he got very, very excited about the possibilities. And one of the problems, the reason it hadn't been done before, was that superconductors don't like high magnetic fields. And if you put them in a fairly high magnetic field, the superconductivity quenches, mm-hmm. just disappears at what is called the critical field. Now I'm talking about low temperature superconductors.
Right.
High temperature superconductors have similar problems, but in a much more complex,
mm-hmm.
complex way. But this is way before the discovery of the low temperature superconductor. We started looking first at superconductors with relatively high critical temperatures, because it had been observed that the higher the critical temperature, the higher the critical field,
mm-hmm.
in a given material. And Gene started with lead bismuth alloys, which were known to have a fairly high critical temperature. And he found that he could generate, make the alloy, which fortunately, being in the metallurgical department, we could get that done, and draw it into wire and insulate it and make yourself you could insulate it by electroplating it with copper or what have you, because the copper would be a good conductor, but not a superconductor,
right.
And served as a perfectly good insulator. And he got fields of, I don't remember the numbers, but it was, I think, up in the 1 or 2,000 Gauss level, which was really kind of interesting, but not high enough. What Rudy really needed was at least 10,000 Gauss. There was in the physics department at that time a physicist called Bernd Matthias, who had done an awful lot of work in superconductors and discovered the materials with the highest known critical temperatures. And that was a material compound of niobium and tin, NB3SN, niobium. The problem with that material, though, was that it's very brittle. It's a ceramic,
mm-hmm.
like material, and making wires it was a non-trivial matter. On the other hand, there were other alloys. I think they were primarily alloys of titanium and vanadium that had intermediate temperatures that could be drawn into wire. And so Gene made some magnets of those, and they were up in the several thousand Gauss, but still not good enough. And so the question was, where do we go from there? It was sometime around there that Gene and I made a bet. It was kind of a one-way bet, but I was a supervisor, so I guess that was okay. I promised him a bottle of scotch for each 2,000 gauss by which he could raise the critical field at liquid helium temperature. Well, the real breakthrough came about with the same technician I mentioned before, Ernie Bueller,
mm-hmm.
Who grew the silicon single crystals. Ernie was one of these people who I think had just most a high school degree. But he was a very, very bright guy and just extraordinarily imaginative with things mechanical. And his proposition was, why don't we take niobium metal and tin metal in the proper ratio and then clad it with some metal, stuff it in a tube,
mm-hmm.
essentially, and then see if we can draw that down into a structure. And if we pick the outer coating with the proper ductility, we can keep the relatives of niobium and tin. We can make a good kind of coaxial structure mm-hmm. with a niobium tin in the center. And then that's why we'll wind a coil. And then we'll heat it up
mm-hmm.
and let the niobium and tin react and form niobium 310. Well, that's what this is.
Mm-hmm.
And I've forgotten what the metal is on the outside. I think it's probably stainless steel tube that was used. Did I write that down here? No. But they make a coil like this, without the plastic part of it, because it had to be heated up several hundred degrees centigrade. I forget what it was, and then cooled down carefully, and then measured. And the the first measurements were. They ran out of power. They couldn't drive it to the critical field. And so they had to build a whole new rig and got it up eventually to well over 100,000 gallons. And you divide that by two and you get a lot of scotch. Gene let me off the hook. I think he let me off the hook with two cases. And that's that story. That was done, I think, around 1960. It's interesting. Just at the same time this work was done, the first helium neon. I think it was a helium neon laser. Ali Javad at Bell Labs was also built, and so we had two press releases within the same week or two: one on the superconducting mm-hmm. magnet and one on the continuous wave helium neon laser. Those were exciting times.
Yes. Yeah.